Hello, everyone. Welcome to Open the Pod Bay Doors. My name is Faiton Snow, and I'm going to be your host today. I'm one of the co-founders of Innovation Bay, along with Ian Gardner. This podcast is brought to you by Innovation Bay. We're a global network of tech founders, investors, and connectors, and our aim is to support founders on their journey from idea to IPO and beyond. We've been doing this a long time, since 2003, and we're active with over 5,000 members. Now, if you're interested in connecting, learning, and building relationships with other tech founders and investors, check us out and become a member. You can apply for membership at innovationbay.com. Firstly, Happy New Year. I hope you've all had a chance to take a bit of a breather and a break, and have started January in a positive way. When I look back on 2020, it's with really kind of confused and mixed feelings. For Innovation Bay, it was a very positive year of growth and value adding to our membership base, building the team, but it was also very stressful in terms of how the goalposts continued to move with COVID. I'm really looking forward to 2021 for a number of different reasons, but I know there's a long way before we kind of get to any kind of level of stability. It's been a really weird year for me in terms of content and listening to how the media has reacted to what's going on throughout the year. I'm sure we've all sat at home, not traveling anymore, and been bombarded by this tirade of different forms of content and sensationalism. Today, I'm interviewing the founder of Future Crunch. If you haven't had a chance to get on and have a look, I'd highly recommend it. Angus Harvey and his co-founder have created a really interesting platform, which is all about intelligent optimism. They have a great section on the website, which is all about positive news stories. And it's really added a lot to me over the last year to be able to jump on the website and read what's going on in the world in a positive way. I'm not sure if anyone's read Steven Pinker's book, Enlightenment Now. It's a really interesting premise that actually talks about how the world is in a much better place than it ever has been. Now, if you listen to the media, you probably wouldn't agree with that in any kind of way. And this is where the intelligent optimism part comes in, because it's really about thinking and understanding the data and the analytics of where we're at, and then appreciating the fact that actually the world is in a better place for a number of different reasons. We've still got a long way to go in a number of different areas, such as renewable and climate change. But in general, the people living out of poverty, people living without disease, the level of education, and a whole bunch of other factors is actually improving at a very rapid scale. So today we're going to be talking to Angus about intelligent optimism, about where he thinks the market's kind of going, about his experiences of growing a subscription content business and being an entrepreneur in general. I thought this was a great way to kick off the year. Now, a side note, we actually recorded this in late September. So this podcast has been sitting in the pipe for a little while. We've had a huge amount of volume on the podcast, and so it's taken us a little while to get around to this one. But as we were thinking about where to cue it, we sort of thought, what a great way to kick off the new year with this sort of podcast. I love talking to Angus. He's such an interesting guy. He's been on our web streams in the past before. He grew up in South Africa. He's got a PhD out of London, and now we're lucky enough to have him residing in Melbourne. So let's start the year in a good way by talking to Angus Harvey, founder of Future Crunch. Hey, Angus, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on Open the Pod Bay Doors.
Thanks very much, Faiton. It's great to be here.
Yeah, and we're recording after some good news coming out of Melbourne over the weekend, so it must make you very happy.
That's right. I think it's good to feel both the lifting of the seasons and the lifting of spirits. So I think we're all feeling a bit better here.
Indeed. And we had you on the podcast a little while ago. You're on the news podcast, which was awesome. So it's kind of first interaction with each other.
That was fun. Yeah. I love that. That was a great podcast and a great cast of characters that you've managed to round up.
Yeah, it is. It is always a lot of fun. And I remember that the first time I came across you guys, a really good friend of mine out of Sydney was saying, have you heard these guys? They spoke at one of the events that the company ran the other day, and they really blew my mind. And it's great to come across people, I think, who are so evangelical about something. You know, it's super interesting. So it was great to finally connect with you and see what you're doing in general. And we'll get onto that in a minute about Future Crunch, because it's an awesome site. But first, let's a little bit of background about you and this, you know, intelligent optimism side. So, you've got a PhD in economics, but how does a South African who's got a PhD from the London School of Economics end up in Australia talking about the future of the world?
There's the official story and then maybe the not so official story to that one.
Yeah.
Why don't we do a mix of both?
Excellent.
I was I didn't move to Australia to further my career opportunities and place myself at the center of the debate. However, the move to Australia has been fantastic. I've been here for a decade and I just couldn't be happier. I'll get onto that a little bit later.
Yeah, awesome.
I moved to Australia for the tried and tested reason that I fell in love with an Australian girl.
Mm. It's our biggest export, I think.
The oldest story in the book. Well, Australian boys and girls, to be honest. I think the youth of Australia managed to drag back their fair share of overseas residents, lured by not only love, but the promise of sunny skies and beautiful beaches.
That is exactly. My wife's Danish, so we share something in common there. We both pulled, well, you're international, I pulled someone from international. So, yeah, it is a great place to live at the end of the day. But an interesting place to kind of build a business, because that's what you're doing at the moment, right?
Yeah, that's right. So I moved to Australia. My partner and I met at a psychedelic music festival in Portugal in 2010. I moved to Australia at the end of 2011. And it was tough in the beginning. I struggled to find a job. No one was impressed with either my credentials and possibly my accent. And I ended up having to create my own job, which eventually spun out into Future Crunch.
Mm, that's awesome. So tell us a little bit about the business. And this, you know, you've coined this term, which I love, intelligent optimism.
I would love to claim that I coined that term. That it's actually a broader term that's used to describe a kind of I suppose you could call it a global movement, really, of people who look at the world perhaps a little differently to how most other people look at the world. Future Crunch was founded on two basic principles. One is that the world is a much better place than we think. And the second is that science and technology are what drives and changes human progress. And so really Future Crunch is about, it's a thought leadership company, or maybe perhaps you could call it a think tank. We've also been called a speaking company, a media company. We kind of sit in that space of thought leadership and influence. Mm. And we talk about and write about and broadcast our enthusiasm and unbridled enthusiasm for the power of science and technology, and also this idea of intelligent optimism, that there are many, many good things happening out there in the world, that there are millions of people working to make the world a better place. And despite all the challenges that we face, there are a lot of really good things going on as well.
How did you get onto that? Like what's led you down this pathway? Because the website, if people haven't been there, you need to go there, is fantastic. And you've just started up a subscription business on the content side, which makes a shitload of sense. But how did you get onto this?
It really came out of my background. I'm an economist, but my interest has always been in environment and sustainability.
Right.
And I think after years, even decades of looking at so much bad news, it kind of forced me to say, look, it can't all be this bad. That's impossible. We're on a planet here of 7.5 billion people. Mm-hmm. Surely there are people out there who are working to make the world a better place. And surely we're having some success stories, not just in the environment, but in terms of social progress as well. Mm-hmm. Once I changed that lens, once I said, where are the good news stories and where is progress happening? And then went and looked for that. It was incredible. I found so much. And so with that mindset, I teamed up with my co-founder, Tane Hunter, who is a scientist. And we decided to form Future Crunch as a sort of a conversation, really, between the two disciplines of economics and politics and science and technology. Mm-hmm. And really, that's been the conversation we've been having for the last 6 years. And it's been an incredibly fruitful one.
Yeah, there's amazing content. Where do you source your content from? I mean, obviously a range of different channels, but it must take time to find, because it seems like a variety of different places.
I source my content from the internet. What I love about that is, you know, my job wouldn't have existed 10 years ago. I could not do my job without the internet. And so I'm what you might call a grandfather millennial, in the sense that, and I'm also what people call the cusp generation. So I'm old enough to remember what life was like before the internet. But I'm young enough to have always been on the internet. I've been on the internet since I was 11 or 12 years old. And I grew up in a house with technology. My mother is a software engineer and has been coding since the 70s. So she can run rings around all the programmers.
So and, how that's so different, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it just meant that I grew up in a world where internet, digital, computers, programming, coding, that was all just normal to me. It didn't feel like something that was outside or inaccessible.
Yeah.
So what I love about the internet is that most of the conversation that people are having about the internet is how terrible and awful it is. The internet, people have tend to have forgotten that it's the greatest information resource humanity has ever known. And if you get your filters right and you use the internet, you become a power user, make sure you're not stuck in your filter bubbles, make sure you're not stuck on social media. It is an incredibly powerful tool for sourcing amazing information.
So we're reading a lot about the negativity of social media at the moment. Places like Facebook, et cetera, right? Do you source content out of Facebook?
No.
Yeah.
No, I treat Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter like drugs. I might occasionally dip in, and when I say drugs, I'm talking about the wider category of mind-altering substances, and that includes everything from cigarettes and alcohol to LSD. Mm-hmm. So social media to me is a combination of drugs and junk food.
Yeah.
I might touch it once in a blue moon, but it is so dangerous, so addictive, and so obviously bad for your health that I stay as far away from it as I possibly can.
Do you put Twitter into that category?
I do, absolutely. Yeah.
Why? Yeah. Why is that? Because Twitter, I always found Twitter being a little bit different from like a Facebook.
Twitter is, I think, the powerful thing about Twitter is your ability to curate your information stream is more powerful than other social media platforms. And Twitter can be a fantastic place, you know, if you're on tech Twitter, for example, it can be a fantastic place to connect, gain influence, get followers, get good new ideas. But it's so dangerous. The downside of it is so addictive that I end up wasting time on Twitter when I could be doing it, when I could be more productive in other areas.
Yeah, right.
And as a writer and someone who needs to produce content, Twitter is a very dangerous distraction for me. So I just don't go on it.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Fair enough. So if we go back to this intelligent optimism phrase that you haven't coined, but is a global movement, how do we define it?
So intelligent optimism, the way to think about it, you can put it into, there's, I suppose, three lenses which you can use as an intelligent optimist, or maybe three principles. The first is that you take a historical perspective. You look at the story of human progress, not over 10 or 5 years, but you look at it over a course of 20, 50, 100 years.
Yeah.
And if you look at the longer story of human society in the last 50 to 100 years or 200 years, it is a story of extraordinary progress. We've lifted billions of people out of poverty. Billions of people now have access to life-saving medicines, to vaccines. Poverty has decreased to historically low levels. Tolerance, equality on everything from same-sex marriage to women's rights, although they're obviously not good enough yet, they are better than they ever have been. So if the past is a country, the past was an awful country, and the present, although it's not better yet, is a much better place than the past ever was. And so this kind of nostalgic lens that most people have for the good old days. The good old days were not good old days. They were racist, sexist, and terribly unprogressive in a way that the modern era isn't.
Mm.
So the first is you take a historical perspective when you're trying to figure out where we are as the human race. The second pillar of intelligent optimism is that you use facts, not narrative. And so the majority of our opinions about how the world is right now, they're informed by media. And media doesn't tell you what's happening in the world. It tells you what's rare in the world. Mm. That's the whole point of media. So if you're trying to get an accurate idea of what life is like for the average person on planet Earth today, the news is a terrible place to find that. So you need to look at facts and data and evidence. And when you look at large data sets from the World Bank or from the United Nations, or you look at poverty data sets, or you look at national income, or you look at healthcare interventions. Those the evidence and the data tells a much better story than the news tells.
Right.
And that's fairly obvious. The news has to sell papers and has to generate clicks. And the way to do that is to talk about death, destruction, and disaster rather than progress, equality, and tolerance.
Mm. Steven Pinker, not Daniel, came out with a really interesting book, obviously in 2011, which was the Better Angels of Our Nature. And I think the first time I came across it was when Bill Gates kind of talked about it in his, you know, year best books. But it hasn't, I mean, not a lot of people talk about it. And, you know, when I talk about it with my partner, for example, you know, she really questions whether it has become a better world or not. So what do you think it is that we don't accept where we are, maybe?
So this is, so when I was talking about intelligent optimism as a global movement, this really, that book, Better Angels of Our Nature, really is probably the seminal kind of event in this idea of intelligent optimism. It brought, it provided the backing for someone who said the world is going to become a better place and said there is actually evidence for this.
Yeah.
And so it's not just Steven Pinker. Hans Rosling was the other really big figure in this movement of intelligent optimism. He wrote a book called Factfulness, which has also been popularized by Bill Gates. Bill Gates is a great person. He's an intelligent optimist. And then the other person who is very important for the movement is a guy called Max Rosa from the University of Oxford, who publishes a website called Our World and Data, where they look at the evidence of what's happening in the world as opposed to media and narrative. And it's a really fantastic resource for anyone who's interested in what's actually happening in the world as opposed to what the news tells you is happening in the world. So the reason that people tend to reject this idea of intelligent optimism, it perhaps comes into this third pillar of intelligent optimism, which is that the goal of an intelligent optimist is not to say is not to sing kumbaya and say the world's a wonderful place and none of us have to do anything anymore. One of the central pillars of intelligent optimism is to be honest about where we're not succeeding. And the truth is that there are many areas that the world isn't becoming a better place. And so if you look, for example, at the environmental crisis or the climate change crisis, which are tied up together, or, for example, you look at the retreat of democracy in a number of countries or the rise of authoritarianism and populism, those are major problems. Or, for example, you look at rampant economic inequality, the widening gap between the haves and the have-nots. Those are problems that we need to fix. They are very severe problems. And those are the problems that get a lot of attention in media and news. And so if you go to the average person, you say to them, is the world becoming a better place? They'll say to you, no, climate change, environmental crisis, economic inequality, rising populism, we're screwed. What the intelligent optimist says is, those things are all true, but it's also true that we've solved so many of our challenges. Nuclear proliferation. We've solved, poverty in so many developing countries. We've brought billions out of poverty. AIDS. AIDS deaths have reached their lowest since 1993. In the last 12 months, we've figured out a medicine, ARVs, that can actually solve that crisis. And so the intelligent optimist says we face challenges, but the challenges that we've solved in the past should give us confidence as we move forward into the future that we can solve these future challenges as well. So it's not a way of looking at the world and saying everything's going to be wonderful. It's a way of looking at the world and saying, yes, we have issues, but we are also an incredibly adaptive, resilient, and kind species, and we can solve these problems that we have going forward into the future.
So you feel confident that you're not going to buy a ticket on Elon Musk's rocket ship to Mars as a safe haven, that we are going to be able to kind of work our way through?
Musk is a fantastic avatar for anyone who he's kind of a Rorschach test for anyone for anyone's opinion of the world. Yeah. If you believe the world's going to hell in a handbasket, Elon Musk is symbolic of everything that's wrong with the way the world currently works. On the other hand, if you are a sort of techno-optimist that just thinks everything's going to be wonderful, then Elon Musk is the Lord and our savior. An intelligent optimist has a much more nuanced view where you can, for example, say, look, the idea that we're going to set up another civilization on another planet and use that as our escape plan. That is a terrible idea. Whereas the idea of going to Mars for exploration's sake is a wonderful idea. On the other hand, if you look at what Elon Musk has done simply on electric vehicles, single-handedly, that he is responsible and probably will be responsible for a greater reduction in global carbon emissions from a single person than any other person on the planet. So it's okay for us to celebrate people for what they've done well and also to criticize people for ideas they have that may not be, you know, as admirable.
Yeah, as well as all the battery stuff that he's doing. He's done in Adelaide, and I think he's talking to Mike Cannon-Brookes about the potentials for New South Wales at the moment, which is super exciting.
And also, my feeling on Elon Musk can do whatever he wants. He can say whatever he wants. Just on batteries and electric vehicles alone, he has earned the right to do whatever he wants, honestly. I think the media misses that a lot.
Yeah, totally. We need people that are just out there, I think. And we love him. We love talking about him on the show because there's always a great talking point at the end of the day. He's always doing something super interesting. And we're really hopeful that actually he will do something with Mike and in New South Wales, given the current predicament there. What do you think, just quickly, we'll get over this. You know, you've started this subscription business around positive news, right? Intelligent optimism, and it's doing really well. But historically, newspapers sell on, you know, the world's ending type of scenario. How do you balance those two things out? Is there a move away from that now?
Or newspapers don't sell on that historically. Newspapers sell on that currently.
Yeah, right.
You can go look at your news. Go look at a newspaper or go look at a media site right now.
Yeah.
Go look at your Facebook feed right now. Yeah. It is death, destruction, carnage. I mean, it is awful, and no wonder everyone is feeling upset. Media is in a really interesting. The media industry more broadly is in a very interesting place right now, in the sense that the last 10 years has been carnage, you know, layoffs, the media business model has been well and truly upended. I mean, obviously the business model got upended 10 years ago by digital media, but really we're now seeing the chickens come home to roost. And so there's been a wave of layoffs, publications going under, local newspapers going under, the kind of centralization into, you know, to a few big players in the media sphere. And it's not great for democracy for that to happen. The flip side of that, however, is that the internet, and one of the beautiful things about digital media is that there's a long tail. And so instead of having just the big end of town plus a few satellites, we now have this really interesting distribution of media on the internet where individual writers or thinkers are now separating out from publications and are gathering their own followings. So instead of having 100 big publications with 100,000 followers each, we now have 100,000 small little publications all running newsletters or Patreon programs or subscriber models with 1,000 subscribers each. And that creates a much more diverse, much more interesting media field. And so FutureCrunch's move to the subscription model is really part of a much bigger wave towards subscription-based models for media more generally. What's beautiful about subscription models and what's beautiful about the internet is Kevin Kelly's 1,000 true fans theory, which is that you only need 1,000 true fans to build a successful online business. What they're now saying is there's now the emergence of a new idea, which is called the passion economy, and that you don't just need 1,000 true fans. You can actually get away with 100 true fans, people who are going to do and buy everything that you produce, the hoodies, the T-shirts, the subscription-based models, the extras. And if you have 100 people that really, truly love what you do and will buy everything and consume everything that you do, you have the basis to build yourself a successful online business. And so FutureCrunch, we've been running a newsletter for the last 5 years. We've been doing newsletters since before they really kind of became cool. Although newsletters have always been cool. They've been around since the 90s. And so we had a pretty big subscriber base. We had about 40,000 subscribers, which we built up over 5 years. And we then made the move across to a subscription model. And it's been really successful. And it's given us a brand new income stream. And subscription models are wonderful because they give you a consistent income stream. You don't have to worry about cash flow. And also you build a personal relationship with your subscribers and followers.
Yeah, yeah. Content's never easy to monetize. I think that's where big media historically has made that difficult transition, isn't it? But it sounds to me like what you're saying now, we're in this kind of resurgent middle phase, I guess, where a lot of people like yourself and other people that have maybe been working for media companies have gone out on their own and they've got this kind of network following, these influencers who are creating more followers for, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of really interesting businesses are kind of emerging in this space right now. Where do you think it'll play out to?
Well, content, it's really interesting how the conversation has changed. 5 years ago, remember the content?
Yeah.
If you are building any business, you have to start a blog and you have to push out content. It had to be regular, et cetera, et cetera. It turns out that people didn't want more content. People wanted more good content. Mm. And people are far more willing to pay for one really good thought piece once a month, perhaps with a few extra bits and pieces, than they are willing to pay for a blog that's producing 5 posts a day. Mm. So it's never been the case that content is king, but it's always been the case that good content is king. And so what this move towards a sort of subscription model tells me is that people are willing to pay money for content that provides value, that gives them an alternative perspective that they're not getting anywhere else, and content that feels personal and is in the writer's voice. And, you know, the writer uses their personality and their unique view in the world to. And the thing about big media companies is they don't have any of those.
Yeah.
The content doesn't provide value. It just provides sensationalism and it generates clicks. That content, it doesn't have a personal voice. It's in the voice of the media brand. And media brands can't really have voices in the same way that individuals can. And they don't provide alternative points of view because they're all singing from the same hymn sheet.
So
the exceptions prove the rule here.
So where do you think it's going to play out?
Very interesting. I don't know. I think we're in this, classic bundling, unbundling theory of digital. I think we're in a massive unbundling phase right now for media. And sure enough, 5 years from now, we'll see a massive bundling up again. But right now, we're in a major unbundling phase. And it's a very exciting time if you're a content creator to go have another look at newsletters, at alternative subscription models, at new ways of generating revenue. People are hungry for great content.
Mm. Okay. Let's move on to tech because I really want to talk a little bit about tech. I've listened to some stuff that you said in the past before, and we've obviously talked last week just about how you see technology in general helping us or being the enabler for change and positive change in many ways. There are specific areas that you like to think about or focus on. Tell us a bit about those areas.
This is the other side of Future Crunch, and I'm just as passionate about this side, if not more passionate than the kind of the good news and human progress side.
Yeah.
The human progress side fills my heart up. Technology is what fills up my head, and it is just, I'm an unashamed proponent and enthusiast about technology. And I feel like the kind of tech backlash that we're experiencing globally now, is not reflective of the tech industry itself.
Mm.
The large majority of people that I meet in science and technology fields and in tech are fantastic, wonderful, open-hearted people who want to make a real difference. And that is true regardless of what the media says. That being said, so the big three areas of technological progress coming down in the future, they broadly map onto, I suppose, what you could call a suite of technologies on AI and machine learning, which really is the evolution of digital. So that's the next phase, I suppose, of our ones and zeros. Then there's a huge technology stack around clean energy and sustainability and regenerative approaches to rebuilding our economy, circular economy, etc. And then there's another stack on healthcare, and in particular, sort of biotechnology, genetic editing, and genetic editing specifically. So if you look at those three areas, they map to, I suppose, what you could call communications, our communications technologies, which is ultimately what AI and machine learning is. Our energy technologies, which is everything from transport to clean energy to power production. And then a sort of healthcare technologies and gene editing in particular there, but also brain machine interfacing. I think starting to see some interesting developments there as well. So and a third way of looking at this, the first is ones and zeros, so bits and bytes. The second is electrons and molecules, oil, electrons, things that make things go.
Yeah.
And then the third is cells and atoms. So the stuff of life itself, DNA.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And those are the three areas of big technological progress that are going to drive the next industrial revolution.
So what are you loving in, say, AI, machine learning and that sort of space? We'll talk about each of these, but what sort of initiatives or technologies are you looking at in those sort of spaces? And maybe more clearly, what have you seen emerge that you think's made an impact?
Oh, where to begin?
Yeah, yeah. Give me your top couple. There's a lot. And machine learning and AI obviously covers pretty much everything, right? So very broad. So it really is for tech in general, but, yeah. You know.
All right. Why don't we talk about the difference between AI and machine learning first, yeah. And then I'll tell you what I'm enjoying in that space. There's a wonderful quote from Matt Veloso, I think, who's the chief technical advisor to Satya Nadella. I think he said this about 2 years ago, which is that if it's written in Python, it's machine learning. If it's written in PowerPoint, it's AI.
Okay.
So what he's trying to say there is that machine learning is what people who actually do this call it. Yeah. It is hard, difficult code that you have to write. You have to gather and parse a ton of data. A lot of it is new. It's incredibly powerful if you can get it right, but it's certainly not a magic wand that you can wave and say, AI everything and the future is cognitive and hip, hip, hooray, and off we go into the brave new world. AI, on the other hand, is what we call it for the general public and in newspapers and on PowerPoint, which means that if you're doing a presentation to a large group of people, you call it artificial intelligence because that's what everyone knows it as. And artificial intelligence is a Rorschach test for whatever you feel about technology. If you think technology is awful, then artificial intelligence is going to come and destroy all of us and lead us to a dystopian future. And if you think technology is wonderful, then artificial intelligence is going to give birth to new forms of intelligences that will save human race. Those are narratives. They're not reality.
Yeah.
So my favorite machine learning technologies that I'm really enjoying because artificial intelligence is not really a thing. Artificial intelligence is a term that we use in stories. It's not a term that we use in technology. My favorite machine learning technologies, I think there's an incredibly powerful stack of machine learning technology that's now powering everything we use in day-to-day life when we talk about tech. And to an extent that most people don't know, if you look at the top 10 most downloaded apps on the iPhone last year, every single one of them incorporates machine learning. So Facebook incorporates machine learning to change your newsfeed. Google Maps incorporates it to figure out the best method to get from A to B. Mm-hmm. Instagram uses it, to make recommendations in your feed. Snapchat, no cute cat filters without machine learning. TikTok, obviously famous for its algorithm that is its proprietary value, and the list goes on. So we already use machine learning every day in our lives, and everyone who's listening to this has used machine learning a number of times in the last week.
Yeah,
so it's already here. In terms of new companies coming down the line, I'm actually really interested not so much in the use of machine learning in, I suppose, what we could call traditional tech or digital. I'm interested in the applications of machine learning to systems that are being used in the real world, that are using atoms rather than bits and bytes. Let me try to explain that. One of my favorite Australian companies is Fastbrick Robotics. They build, they're out of Western Australia. They build a robot called Hadrian X,
right.
Which is a bricklaying robot. And they have just finished building their first, I think they've just finished their first commercial build somewhere out in Western Australia.
Yes.
Mike Pivak, I think is the founder of that company. Yeah. That technology, he's been working on that since 1994. But they finally got it right because machine learning has gotten good enough to be able to build a robot that can lay bricks faster than a human being. Another company.
And tell me why you think that is interesting.
It's interesting because it changes the way we think about jobs and automation, and it changes what we think robots can be good at. Robots traditionally have been used for tasks that are dirty, difficult, and dangerous. And this is in Japan, they call this the triple K principle. I think it's Kitanai, Kaiken, and there's a third Japanese word.
Yeah.
And of course, the Japanese are very good at robots. They've been using it for a while. So dirty, dangerous, and difficult. And so if you can build a robot that replaces a dirty, dangerous, or difficult task, then that's something, it's highly automatable.
Sure.
What's really interesting now is we're starting to see robots move beyond just the tasks that are dirty, difficult, or dangerous. We're starting to see the robots now take on all tasks that are repetitive. So stacking a warehouse shelf, Boston Dynamics obviously built their warehouse stacking robot. That's now, arriving pretty soon to a warehouse near you. Walmart now employs robots that clean the floor and do stock take. Those are jobs that aren't necessarily dirty, difficult, or dangerous, but they are highly repetitive.
So how do you feel about people saying, well, what about the impact that has on society in terms of unemployment or people that are doing those jobs at the moment?
It's complicated, but the key thing to remember here is that robots don't replace jobs. Robots replace tasks within jobs.
Mm.
And so if the majority of a job involves tasks that are repetitive, then that is a highly automatable job. But if your job, for example, involves a few tasks that are repetitive, your job is not necessarily, the job itself is not necessarily replaceable. So for example, your job as a podcaster, one of your many jobs. I know you have many many different hats. But there are tasks within the role of being a podcaster that are very repetitive, and that eventually, with the stack of machine learning technologies that we are producing, a machine can take over many of those tasks. So, for example, a machine could go through this entire conversation that we have, maybe within 3 or 4 years, and it can pick out all the mistakes.
Makes us more efficient. Do you think robots and machine learning creates jobs? Do you think there's, we just can't quite see that yet.
Absolutely.
But there's a fear from maybe, again, there's a fear everywhere, which is understandable because people don't really understand some of these things. But there's also an entrenched maybe part of the ecosystem or part of the economy here that doesn't want change.
Well, and has always been so. I don't want to get into conversations about Luddites, but
yeah.
But what's interesting is that 5 years ago, when we first started seeing that many jobs are going to be automated, the predictions of job loss were apocalyptic.
Crazy. That's right. Yeah.
Oxford, I think, had a famous study saying 47% of jobs are going to be automated. There were a number of studies that were specific to Australia that said Australia is going to lose 2 to 3 to 5 million jobs. Interestingly, in the last year, there have been a number of new studies that have said that the net job loss is actually going to be negative, in the sense that we're actually going to create more jobs from these technologies than are going to be lost. However, in that changeover, some segments of society lose out and some segments of society win. And so the question is politically, and this is something the technologists always seem to forget, which is that technology is never politically neutral. It involves questions of distribution, who gets what, where, when, and how. But the people who lose out, have a louder voice, are more politically influential, then your technology gets pushed back.
Yeah.
As opposed to people who are gaining, are more politically powerful, then the technology goes ahead. And so it always comes down to questions of politics. And I just wish I could grab technologists and say, you can't ignore culture, you can't ignore society, you cannot ignore politics. You need to understand how that works.
Yeah.
Because it's just as important, if not more so.
It's a good question, isn't it? Because obviously the majority of our network is our founders and investors, right? And it is hard for a founder to think about maybe social broad impact sometimes, or the political aspect to what they're doing until it's maybe like, too late in some ways, or they're having that impact, they're reeling it back. A bit like Facebook is at the moment. I wonder what steps you could take as a founder to start thinking about that, because you and Aris is in essence creating a new market. And when you're doing that, it's very hard to predict the impact you're going to have.
Yeah, that's right. But I think even just asking the question, saying, what are the effects of this beyond the purely technological? So many people who are in the technology world have engineering backgrounds and just seem completely befuddled when a technology has adverse social consequences, or when the government doesn't seem to be totally gung-ho about adopting the technology. Clean energy is a case in point, but many other areas as well. So instead of saying, why are they so stupid? How can they not see the light? You change the question. You say, why do they seem to think that, why are the decision makers making the decisions they're making, and who has power and influence over them? And using that as your starting point, rather than just saying, everyone's stupid, can't they see it my way?
Yeah, and I do think it's changing a lot. You know, I think it's changing from a purely monetization aspect, right, which is I've got to generate money, and I've got to, money is my primary focus, to I do feel like the conversation's evolving to, how do I make an impact? How do I get users or of whatever I'm creating to engage on that platform in a meaningful way, which is maybe alleviating the focus purely on the monetization piece. You know, and part of that, I think, is the growth of the venture industry here, which is allowing more breathing space than it historically has, where companies have found it very hard to raise capital. We're still a ways away from that. And money still is the primary purpose of companies, but it's evolving. I want to jump into one of the other themes, because I think clean energy we love, and I can talk about that all day, but genetic editing is a really interesting one, because it feeds into the conversation we're having at the moment a little bit, right? Because most people, I generally sort of say, are pretty shit scared of genetic editing in a way. How do you see it as a positive? Why have you got it on here?
Well, look, genetic editing, again, this comes to media. The stories, the headlines of genetic editing in the last few years have all been all about how, you know, we're going to genetically modify embryos.
Yeah.
Everyone's seen Gattaca. We all know how this one ends.
Yeah.
We end up in dystopia.
What's the reality here?
That is not how genetic editing works.
Yeah.
The kind of... not just the regulatory controls, but the cultural controls around tinkering with DNA are so strong. The kind of cultural norms around it are so strong that genetic editing is not going to just escape from the lab and, you know, suddenly run riot, or we're going to have biohackers, you know, modifying viruses as we go forward into the future.
We're going to have mutants running out in the streets. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, those are great stories, but they bear no resemblance to reality. I think a really interesting case in point was the story of I've forgotten his surname, the Chinese scientist who genetically modified two embryos at the end of 2018. The news came out and it was headline news everywhere. Everyone was horrified, because if you genetically modify embryos, then those changes get passed down through the human germline. So they become permanent. You cannot reverse them. The outcry from the scientific community was unanimous in its condemnation of what he had done. And he was condemned by everyone, almost every scientist around the world. So it sent a very, very clear signal to everyone that you cannot go rogue on these technologies, that they need to be done within a wider process of scientific collaboration and regulation. And so genetic editing has been, well, CRISPR in particular, which is what's really kind of opened up this bag of worms, has been around since 2012.
Right.
But we're only starting to see pilot projects and you know, tests of CRISPR in real world settings in the last year or so. So it's taken the scientific community 9 or 10 years to really say, we want to make sure we've got this right.
Right.
And now we're starting to see and this doesn't make the headline news, but we're starting to see people get edited for sickle cell anemia, for Huntington's disease, the disease, I think it's bubble boy disease. You know, diseases that are horrific, but we're starting to see actual genetic editing being used to cure those diseases. And we've seen this first sort of positive results out of that in the last 12 months or so. That is a game changer for medicine, that we now finally have a technology that can solve some of the worst diseases that humanity knows of on this planet. And not only that, but these technologies are actually, they're going to be accessible to everyone eventually. Because they're going to be managed and run by governments and by health institutions, as opposed to rogue scientists.
Well, we also know there's rogue governments, obviously, and they're out there, right? There's a variety of kind of good and bad on this. You know, currently there's a lot of interesting. Where's the balance between nature and our articulation of nature, do you think? We're getting very theoretical here. I love this. But yeah.
It's a good question, but I mean, there have been rogue governments forever.
True.
It's been possible to create a virus in a lab that would wipe out humanity. That's been possible for 30, 40 years. Mm. But just because it's possible doesn't mean that it actually gets done.
Yeah.
That isn't to say that these technologies don't have potentially terrible side effects and that we need to be very aware of the adverse consequences. You know, I'm not saying that, again, that there are no downsides to this. Yeah. But the upsides are so much greater than the downsides, and we only tend to look at the downsides. So I think that genetic editing is, when you're talking about nature versus technology, genetic editing isn't going to be something that changes what it means to be a human being. Instead, it's going to be more like a vaccine.
Right.
And so if you think about the way that we use vaccines, we use nature's own machinery to inoculate the human race against some of our oldest and deadliest killers. Mm. In the same way, genetic editing uses nature's own machinery to solve some of the most horrible things that we know of in existence. And if anyone has ever had a family member that suffers from anything like sickle cell anemia or cancer, which we're now starting to tackle with genetic editing, then they'll I think they'll really empathize with that point.
And what are you seeing that's really interesting at the moment? Like, where do you think we are at in this?
The what's really exciting, I think, is probably on the cancer front, and that we are starting to use not just genetic modification, but the ability to quickly sequence DNA to actually get early detection of cancer, and then also be able to use the body's own to be able to immunology, so be able to actually use the body's own immune system to fight against diseases like cancer and a myriad of other diseases as well. What's also really interesting is now with this sort of growing realization from the scientific or the medical community that the human body isn't just about our own cells, it's about the cells of other creatures inside us. So we're now starting to see the emergence of microbioinformatics, where we're taking the microbiome, the bacteria and fauna and flora that live inside of us, and we're starting to look at the DNA of the animals that live inside of us as well, and starting to say if we monitor or change the DNA of those animals, then we can change human health as well. So it's not just about genetically modifying human cells, it's about genetically modifying bacteria in order to give us healthier bacteria or healthier microbiomes. And it's a whole new world.
And is someone doing that at the moment? I mean, in Australia
There's a number of kind of research institutes that are looking into those technologies. Yeah. Australia is really interesting. Australia punches well above its weight when it comes to bioinformatics, healthcare, biotechnology. Mm. But the valley of death for Australian biotech is very, very bad. It is very difficult.
Why is that? I wonder.
I think just the combination of the kind of lack of venture capital that's looking in particular at biotech, and also the regulatory kind of barriers that are in place makes it just very difficult to for a talented group of postgrad researchers to take their amazing new technology that they developed in a lab and turn that into a commercially viable product.
Right.
Australia, I think, in the biotech space is probably where the kind of broader tech space was maybe 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah, right.
There's a lot of work that needs to be done in that area to start to get the kind of success stories that we're starting to see in the wider tech area.
I want to flip back to clean energy and renewable energy because there's a lot of debate in the Australian marketplace right now about it and the influence government does and doesn't play. You know, there's a super interesting conversation going on around New South Wales with the federal government being played. But there generally seems to be, from our viewpoint, a lot of mixed information about the impact of renewables versus the need for traditional energy generation. We had Steve Baxter on the show, who's a great entrepreneur up in Queensland, and he said some really kind of interesting stuff about the fact that renewables is just not there yet and unreliable. You know, we've had the Darren Miller, the CEO of the Australian Renewable Energy Agency, on, who countered a lot of those comments in a big way. Why do you think there's not a constant stream of true content in this, because this is science, right? And then a focus.
The reason that the energy debate is so murky is because you're talking about upending the vested interests that have been in place for over 100 years.
Right.
The fossil fuels industry is the largest and most powerful industry that has ever existed. There has never been an industry in human history that has been as powerful. And it's been around for a long time. You know, it's been in place in some form or the other. Some of the oldest fossil fuel companies are over 100 years old.
Right.
So if you think about politics, it's not just that they have influence, it's that the very existence of those companies has become just part and parcel of how our society works.
Right. So this is like confronting the tobacco industry, but on steroids.
It's not even that. I mean, the tobacco industry isn't fundamental to our way of life, but fossil fuels definitely are.
Right.
And so they are into the fossil fuel companies, their interests, their leaders, the way they think, they are interwoven, almost inseparable from our governance systems anymore. So when you have a new disruptive technology like clean energy that comes in and threatens to overturn those vested interests, it's a fight to the death, the likes of which we've never seen before. And so the difficulty of getting good information, it's just exponentially higher because there are evil capitalists, you know, sitting there plotting, you know, rubbing their hands together, saying death to all greenies.
Yeah.
That's just a media story. But it's that people, you're talking here about a clean energy technologies that fundamentally disrupt our entire way of life.
Mm.
And that means that the vested interests will push with everything they have to stop those clean energy technologies from coming through. Mm. And so that's perhaps a bit of a negative view on it. But the positive view here is that as a scientist or technologist, you've got it's a wonderful good news story, because as the price of those technologies keeps on plummeting and will continue to plummet, as the economic argument disappears, we start to see the kind of the sort of political power of those industries almost sort of disappears off a cliff as well. So yeah,
and we know that the renewables will create more jobs than fossil fuels industry currently is. So I wonder why the government isn't driving that. Do you think it is purely lobbyists that are having that influence? I know we're getting a little bit theoretical here, but the startup industry in general that we represent, we do a renewable energy dinner every year. We see a great amount of companies in this sort of space, and we want to see more because there's so much room for growth here. But, you know, it's difficult.
It's very simple. There's a wonderful quote by Upton Sinclair.
Yeah.
Who was a governor of California in the 1930s. And he said, it is very difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends upon him not understanding it.
Mm. Okay.
Now, that's written in the 1930s, so it's well overdue for some diversity training, that particular quote. But I think it remains true that if you got to where you are in politics by behaving in a certain way and thinking in a certain way, it's very difficult to convince someone in that position of power to think in a different way, because everything they've done up to that point in their life has been successful.
Right.
So for people who are in power who don't see any future except for a fossil fuels or gas-led recovery, that's the way they've always thought. Mm. And it's very difficult to get them to change their mind when they are in their 50s and 60s.
I'm going to go back to, you know, what we were talking about before, right? Because there's a balancing act here. And I think you were talking about, say, on genetic editing side, there's a role of government to play in helping regulate the industry, right? A lot of startup founders will, in essence, sort of say, just get the hell out of the way, government, and let us operate and craft because you're a restrictor. What do you think the balance is?
I think the balance here is government having a rethink about what government is actually there for.
What
we think about government for at the moment is that government is there to reduce risk. That perhaps it's the job of the private sector to be risky, dynamic, entrepreneurial, forward thinking and future thinking.
Mm.
And that it's the job of government to make sure that the kids don't get over enthusiastic and to kind of be the sensible voice in the room.
Mm.
I think what would be really useful is a flip And Mariana Mazzucato, who's a British economist, talks about this, which is that we should start to see government more as the entrepreneurial state, and that it is perhaps the job of government to be the lender of first resort rather than the lender of last resort. And so it's the job of government to identify interesting technologies, to identify areas where the private market, where the private sector isn't willing to take risk, and for government to take risk there,
right,
in terms of capital, you know, providing the sort of structures and incentives to promote sort of risk taking in certain areas. And that it's also the job of government to then regulate, you know, once those technologies become viable or commercially available. And so government is there at both the beginning and at the end in order to both take the risk and be entrepreneurial, but then also to, you know, make sure that these technologies are useful for everyone and can and aren't dangerous and don't have adverse side effects. And I think the problem is that in the last 40 years, the message has been that the government isn't there at the beginning. The government's only there at the end.
Right.
I think the government should be at both ends of the pipeline.
So going to this point, you know, I think we were talking about in the news podcast a couple of weeks ago, Facebook, obviously, Google, there's a situation at the moment with the federal government coming in, talking about regulation of content. How do you see that playing out in the context of what you just said?
I think that's a fool's errand. I think it's very difficult to regulate a company who is not based in your jurisdiction.
Right.
The job of regulating the big social media giants should be the job of the United States government, because that's where those companies are housed. I think that it is possible for the Australian government perhaps to put content warnings and adverse, you know, these products can potentially damage your health. So the government can't say we're not going to regulate at all. But in the same way that tobacco companies were regulated in Australia, tobacco companies weren't told that they can't sell cigarettes in Australia, but the Australian government did say we're going to put a warning or a label on this, saying that this has adverse health implications. I think that's a much better way of looking at these products in Australia.
Yeah.
And I wish that we would put health warnings on social media.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Look, we're running out of time, unfortunately. I'm sure we could continue talking for hours. Let's get into quick fire questions, because I'm really keen to hear these from you. And thanks so much for talking to us so far. I really do appreciate it. Favorite book?
I mean,
I read a lot of books. At the moment.
Favorite book at the moment? The book I've enjoyed the most in the last 3 months was a wonderful book called The Biggest Bluff by Maria Konnikova. She is a writer for The New Yorker, and it's her story of – she's a psychology PhD as well, from Columbia University, so she's very smart, great writer. And she set up to become a professional poker player 3 or 4 years ago from scratch, from knowing nothing about professional poker. And it's a wonderful book, not just about poker, but about chance versus luck versus skill versus the ability to learn new skills, how to take on life. It's the best business book I've read this year, and it's not about business at all.
I'm reading it at the moment, and I have to agree. It's a great book.
Biggest Bluff.
What about favorite podcast?
A16Z, their podcast is just so good. Every time I listen, I get something from it. So many tech podcasts are annoying. A16Z just seems to get it right, and they pitch it at a level that really works for me.
And it's consistent. It's great. It covers so many different topics. It's well put together. And it's kind of in bite-sized chunks too, isn't it, really,
yeah, end of the day? It's everything a tech podcast should be. And I wish more people would take a leap from there.
Yeah, they're a great firm. What about news source? Where do you get your news from?
Majority of my news I get from Reddit.
Why Reddit?
What's great about Reddit is it's where that's where everything is on the internet.
Right.
You've got to be able to wade through the muck. And so you require a very good critical eye and a very good understanding of how the internet works. But, Reddit is the unfiltered internet for me. And it's not filtered by, social media algorithms. So it works very, very well.
Yeah.
If you can become a Reddit power user, it's the best information.
What are the tips there to sorting that out?
practice, a bit of experience, sign up to fora that you know, that you think you might be interested in. If it doesn't work for you, unsubscribe from the forum, move on to other somewhere else. Eventually you'll find a forum or a community that works for you. Okay. And then don't check it every day.
Yeah. Okay. Good stuff. Favorite holiday location or destination?
In terms of the other favorite news source, my favorite newsletter is written by someone called McKinley Valentine. It's an Australian newsletter. It has nothing to do with technology, but it is whimsical, funny, and never doesn't have any hot takes on the news. And I always learn something new, and I am highly entertained. It's called The Whippet by McKinley Valentine. And if you like whimsy and humor, and you'll love it.
That's great. Favorite holiday location?
Anywhere in Southern Africa. That's where I'm from.
Yeah.
It's such a beautiful part of the world. Still underexplored, incredible wildlife, unexplored beaches, and it's home, so it feels familiar.
Okay. What about productivity tool?
This is hands down. It's called Cold Turkey Blocker. It's a program that blocks websites and programs on your computer. You can tell it which websites and programs to block. There are a number of these out there, but this is by far the most powerful, and you cannot get around it. I can't disable it, hack it, turn it off, go incognito to overcome it. So what I use that for is I stop myself checking news websites. I stop myself checking social media. I block out days when I'm only going to be writing. I block out days when I'm only going to be doing email. And I couldn't do it without this tool. It's called Cold Turkey.
Very interesting. I've never heard of that one before. What about favorite CEO or tech founder or in that line?
So David Finn, Paul Senior, and James Kennedy, the founders of Tritium in Queensland.
Okay. Who are they?
Tritium is my favorite Australian company, hands down.
Why?
Tritium makes the best and fastest and most in-demand electric car chargers on the planet.
Right.
They are in so much demand, they cannot keep up. They export 98% of their product because Australia doesn't buy it. And they produce a technology that charges electric cars faster than anyone else can. They were founded, I think, about 10 years ago, maybe a bit earlier than that. I think they're up to something like 500 jobs in Queensland now. It's a really advanced, brilliant engineering company, and they are going to take over the world because they're making a product that everyone needs, and they have done it with zero government support.
Wow, that's amazing. I've never heard of those guys. I love the fact that, you know, people talk about how small the Australian ecosystem is, and it's just bullshit because it is so vibrant and so alive and so diverse that you constantly come across companies you've never heard of. I love it.
Let me give you another one very quickly. It's a fantastic company called Conflux Technology, and they make 3D printed heat exchangers. They have the most advanced 3D printed heat exchangers on the planet. They cannot keep up with demand. They export 98% of their product because the Australian government isn't interested and there's no demand here at home. And their clients include everyone from Porsche to McLaren. They make an incredible heat exchanger that cannot be made unless you're using 3D printing technologies. And they use really advanced manufacturing techniques. They're down in, I think they're down in Geelong. Again, amazing engineering company that no one has heard of and are just punching so far above their weight.
Where do you come across these businesses?
The internet.
Yeah. All right. Now, if you're going to do a TEDx talk, what would you do it on?
Just to try to tell people that it's never as bad as you think it is, and it's also never as good as you think it is either. It's always somewhere in between. What you read on the internet, the conversations that you have with your friends, the predictions about the future, it's never as bad and it's never as good as you think it is. It's usually somewhere in between.
This has been great to have you on the show, Angus. I thank you so much. Give us a quick, you know, where's Future Crunch going?
It'll be really interesting to see where we go from here. We're excited about the subscription business. Excited about being part of a broader conversation around how Australia builds back from all of this. Australia has so many incredible advantages on all three of those areas, you know, AI, machine learning, clean energy, and biotech. And I think to be part of that journey in Australia in the next 10 years, to be part of the wider community in making Australia, you know, a place where technology is celebrated, where technology champions are known by the general public, and where the benefits of technology are shared by the general public. I think that's something that's very exciting to us. We want to be a part of that.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks, Arash, for having me.